This conversation was organized by the Center for Human Rights Research at the University of Manitoba. We are located not far from the Red River in the territories of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Anishinaabe, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and Métis peoples. These are lands that are marked by the promises, most of them unfulfilled, of both Treaty 1 and the Manitoba Act. We get our drinking water from Treaty 3 to the east, and our hydroelectric power is sourced from territories to the north and the west, particularly in Treaty 5. It is amid all of these relations and histories that we do the work that we do. Today, that is having a conversation about what it means to learn, teach, and research Canadian history in light of ongoing histories of colonialism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past podcast. I am Hannah Balek, an undergraduate history student at the University of Manitoba and a research assistant at the Center for Human Rights Research. Today, I will interview the research team for the History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past project, Dr. Adele Perry, Dr. Jocelyn Thorpe, and Dr. Jarvis Brownlee, to learn about the project and its goals. So firstly, I will introduce Dr. Adele Perry. Adele is a settler historian and distinguished professor of history and women's and gender studies at the University of Manitoba. She works on histories of colonialism in Northwestern North America in the 19th and 20th centuries and is committed to the transformative work of feminist and decolonizing scholarship. She is also the director of the Center for Human Rights Research and the principal investigator for the History in the Hot Seat project. Next, I will introduce Dr. Jocelyn Thorpe. Jocelyn is a settler scholar and associate professor of women's and gender studies and history at the University of Manitoba. She studies the histories and legacies of colonialism and environmental injustice, as well as the creative ways people work towards a more just world. She is also the director of the Center for Creative Writing and Oral Culture, co-curator of the Decolonizing Lens film and discussion series, and a co-investigator for the History in the Hot Seat project. Lastly, Dr. Jarvis Brownlee is a transgender settler historian and professor of history at the University of Manitoba. He researches Canadian settler colonialism, Crown First Nation relations, treaties and Indigenous rights, hydropower extractivism, and oral histories. He has served as an expert witness in two major court cases relating to treaties, conducted oral history projects in northern Manitoba communities on the topic of treaties, and is currently conducting community-driven research on the impacts of hydro dams. Dr. Brownlee is also a co-investigator for the History in the Hot Seat project. The two other collaborators on the History in the Hot Seat project who could not join us today are Dr. Sean Carleton, a settler scholar and associate professor of history and Indigenous studies at the University of Manitoba, and Matt Henderson, the superintendent of the Winnipeg School Division, who recently completed his PhD at the University of Manitoba and is an instructor in the Faculty of Education at the University of Winnipeg. So welcome, Adele, Jocelyn, and Jarvis. To begin, can you provide an overview of the History in the Hot Seat project and its main objectives?
Sure. So thank you, Hannah. The History in the Hot Seat project is a project that is funded by a particular kind of stream of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, colloquially known as SHRC. And they have had a funding stream over the past few years called Knowledge Synthesis Projects. And these are short, one-year opportunities to have research funded that addresses a particular question. And this year, the competition was organized around evolving narratives and histories. I think I might have that slightly wrong. But it seemed to leave doors open for questions of kind of history in the sense that people make of history as we go about our lives. And so we proposed to do a project that would bring together and assess what we know, what's been written, what's been said about how folks are both thinking and learning and teaching and writing about Canada's past in the years since the winter of Idle No More, which is sort of 2012, 2013. And that is a kind of, I think, in lots of ways, a pretty seismic moment that kind of represented a shift in consciousness and kind of awareness around the past and the present of colonialism. And obviously that is a topic that I think Indigenous people have had little choice but to be aware of. But what we really saw, I think, in those years is a kind of a new awareness or certainly a shifting sort of awareness on behalf of non-Indigenous people and kind of mainstream society. And that was really consolidated with the release of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report 3 years later. And so what this project really does is aims, you know, 10 years down the line to say, like, what's been said in these years? What's been written? Where are we at? Where is the kind of the state of this kind of ongoing conversation? What is the blowback? What is the response in the sense both of uptake of learning about history in new ways, but also of responses to it that have pushed back against that and called for kind of a return to an understanding of Canada's past as kind of salutary and full of good vibes and happy stories.
Benevolent.
So, benevolent, always benevolent. So really as a project, we've been really, really lucky to have three really strong research assistants come on board, including yourself, and draw on a number of people that work with us at the University of Manitoba. And going to kind of have a look at kind of where things are at and hopefully come to some kind of sense and produce some materials that'll be useful for people as they go about their own work.
Could you go into more detail about the materials and the outputs of the project?
Sure. So one of the requirements of this particular stream is that you produce a report that is open access. And so folks who have an internet connection that has suitable download speed can access a report. So we will produce a report that will be available on the Center for Human Rights Research website. But in addition to that, we are going to be doing a series of podcasts. And this is something that you, Hannah Balak, are taking kind of the lead on organizing. And we're hoping that this is a way to find another way of both kind of checking in on where we're at with the project, but also of kind of communicating our kind of findings and our research. So we're looking at three kind of main kind of bodies of writing, thinking, talking, showing. One of that is scholarly kind of literature, kind of conventional academic publications, peer-reviewed in libraries, all that sort of stuff. We're looking at what sometimes is referred to as gray literature, which is kind of an amorphous term, but it refers to things, publications that exist somewhere between scholarly and kind of popular. So things that are often produced by community organizations, policy folks, educational offices, that kind of thing. And then we are also looking at popular kind of media produced either kind of online or in digital or print or visual medium. All of these are places where people talk about history in all sorts of ways. And we're trying to kind of get a gauge on what that where that conversation is at, you know, more than a decade after Idle No More.
Hmm. Could you talk about the upcoming workshop as well?
Oh yeah, the workshop. So one of the ideas for that we had when we originally kind of planned this out would be to do a workshop that was aimed at folks who work in classrooms as educators and teachers. So we are going to be organizing a two-day, kind of a one morning and one afternoon workshop that is open to teachers at all levels, so nursery to 12. It will be co-sponsored by the Winnipeg School Division. We're going to be having one day at the University of Manitoba's Fort Garry campus, where our colleagues at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation will be coming to speak to us. And then we're going to be having another day that will be based at Wolseley School in the Winnipeg School Division. And that is a location that offers us kind of a window into questions of the way that certain aspects of Canada's past are commemorated in things like the names of schools and the names of streets. And other aspects of Canada's past are less visible and less represented. So that workshop will run August 27 and 28. And if people are interested in participating, you can go to chrr.info and you'll find material and registration there, and it will be free of cost and open to teachers at all levels. The team here will be involved, and we're also going to be joined by our colleague Lindsay Gibson from the Faculty of Education at the University of British Columbia, who is a member of the historical thinking kind of research team, but is also currently involved in writing and researching the history of school naming and commemorative practices with a focus on Vancouver, but it turns out there's a huge overlap between Vancouver and Winnipeg in this particular matter. So we hope it'll be kind of a couple of days to learn more about where folks are at and to kind of talk about how we might move forward, what resources people might need, what they might want to contribute to this conversation.
As current historical educators, can you discuss the state of historical education today and how you think the project will impact it?
A lot of what we teach is often what we ourselves learned. And we, of course, relearn things. You know, we learn new material, we move on, we integrate that into our practice. But I think one of the things that I'm really sort of struck by is to what extent often the education we received, and that includes the formal parts where somebody said you were learning capital H history and you sat down and you tried to do that, but also the more informal parts where we live in a world and we move through spaces in cities and in towns and in communities and elsewhere where certain histories are kind of acknowledged and celebrated and others are kind of either pushed to the side, sometimes denied outright, and sometimes just kind of marginalized. And so I think one of the things we kind of want to do is like a little bit reflect on that process, but also just kind of have this project as a moment that will hopefully contribute something, a little bit of a stock taking of where we're at. And in particular in a context where there is a kind of a rising tide of residential school denialism, which our colleague Sean Carlton in particular has worked on. You know, there are questions about the kind of the blowback some of these conversations are receiving. And it seems like a good time to kind of assess where things are at and to kind of consolidate some of the materials and make those available to people.
If I could just jump in here, you know, we're seeing in Canada for the last number of years contestation, like public contestation over history that we haven't often seen, like really since I started studying history. So as Adele mentioned, there's fairly organized residential school denialism now, you know, by people, highly placed people, you know, a member of the Canadian Senate, you know, Conrad Black. These people have their own websites and are actively promoting residential school denialism, but there's also been contestation over use of the term genocide for Canada's treatment of Indigenous peoples, especially with respect to residential schools, but also many other features of Canadian colonialism. There was something, fights over statues. Some statues have been taken down at public request by governments. Others have been toppled, you know, famously, and then we've heard commentary, then you get public commentary on that, such as Brian Pallister, our premier at the time, saying that, you know, that the colonizers didn't intend any harm, they just came here, you know, with benevolent intentions, or that's not the exact quote. So it is a good moment to really look at what's being said by both academics and the public about these highly contentious issues.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Jarvis is right in that we really have witnessed a kind of an unprecedented kind of public conversation about these histories. And in lots of ways, the contestation or the complication, the kind of challenges to commemoration of figures such as John A. Macdonald reflects, a really significant degree of public engagement with and knowledge about history. And so I think this is something that we sort of see very much as like a conversation that is ongoing. Commemoration is something that always changes. It is never kind of a static thing. It always tells us more about the society that was doing the commemorating than anything else. And what I think what we've sort of seen is a community that has really been kind of forced to kind of come to grips and have conversations that they may not have wanted to have. But we're seeing it happen, and it's a good moment for folks who care about history and what it means to learn about it and teach it to kind of think about where we're at.
So one of the outputs of this project is the workshop for teachers and other educators. So specifically, how do you envision this project impacting the way Canadian history is taught in elementary, middle, and secondary institutions?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think some of that is probably a question that I would leave to people who study curriculum, which, you know, and I'm not one of those people who do that, and they know a great deal. And I think those of us that are kind of professional historians and university teachers can actually learn a great deal from what people who study curriculum and study teaching and people who teach in classrooms at all levels do. So those are questions that I think they will take up. But I think what we can do is kind of provide kind of material and some sort of reflection, opportunities for kind of engagement, directions to point people in for kind of additional materials, and hopefully some sort of tools of thinking about some of the things that we might think of as a capital H history, but also some of the things that we might think of as just kind of what I think of as using a term that kind of comes out of the American context of racial wallpapering. And the, using the term wallpaper in the sense that that becomes this kind of unspoken backdrop to the lives we live. So it's the streets that are named, it's the schools that are made, it's the reference points that we don't tend to pay a lot of attention to because it's just so naturalized. But those practices of kind of commemoration make an argument. And they make an argument about whose history matters and whose doesn't, and what is worth celebrating and what isn't, what conversations can be had and what are considered unspeakable or too difficult or too complicated. And I think we can have kind of conversation about what it means to think about those kind of practices of how we kind of mark history, not just in history teaching, but in our daily lives.
I think it's about two things. It's partly about having the conversations amongst ourselves in the first instance and then with the teachers. And it's also about stock-taking, you know, as we've been saying, that there's been a really important shift over the past 10 and more years, really, you know, really since residential school survivors started getting taken seriously or started getting somewhere and changing the conversation about colonization. But everyone, myself included, who studies history, you know, we keep up as best we can with the developments that are happening in historical thinking, but there's a lot of it, as you've noticed, I'm sure, as a research assistant, and you keep on top of it as best you can, but it's somewhat random. So this is an opportunity to get a group together and try to get on top of that material together, right, in a way that then becomes something that teachers can use to map out what's out there, get a bit of an overview, and then have, as Adele was saying, sort of, you know, bibliographies and points of reference and things they can more easily find.
Well, I'm thinking about how often history in high school and elementary school is considered sort of irrelevant and far away and something that, you know, your teachers just tell you the facts about the past and you all glaze over and find it a bit boring. So I wonder whether part of the conversation is about making history relevant in the present, which it is, but I don't know that students always see that. And I think that something like Canada Day in Winnipeg, when you see everybody out in their orange shirts, is a really interesting moment of thinking of the history in the present. And you know, when we grew up, then Canada Day was very much about wearing red and carrying a Canadian flag. And now for my kids, Canada Day is about wearing orange and about the idea that every child matters. And Canada flags have come to stand for something different and scarier during COVID when people were protesting. And so anyway, just the way that we can then use that present day example to say, hey, we're talking about history here, and then have it be that people are coming at it more from a perspective of curiosity and asking questions about the present that lead to an understanding of the past rather than thinking of it as, oh, your teachers are just here to tell you boring stuff.
And you all have spoken a bit about residential school denialism and other forms of pushback against kind of retellings of Canadian history. What challenges do you anticipate in conducting this research and achieving the goals of this project?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, some of it are things that are occurring within, you know, this community. And we've already mentioned, Jocelyn's already mentioned the truckers convoy that occurred not too long ago. And partially because I think the way that historical time seemed to kind of both slow down and speed up during the pandemic, it feels both very far away, but it's very close. And I think what we're seeing in particular in the province of Alberta regarding history curriculum tells us about how some of these questions about what Canada is and what is possible within this particular space kind of come to rest in ideas about history and sort of history teaching. So as far as the challenges, I think the exact shape that this sort of kind of blowback has taken and will continue to take is something that is a little bit unclear at this point. But I think some of the challenges is just kind of bringing together the material, because a lot of these conversations are kind of pretty siloed, like they happen in kind of little discrete kind of pockets and bits and pieces. But I think hopefully we can find sort of ways, like threads that are kind of connecting all of this to kind of be sort of put together. I think there is a larger kind of ambivalence about processes of changing, kind of naming and commemorative practices that reflects, I think, you know, settler, colonial, and white privilege at its core, and a feeling that people who grew up in families like mine, you know, lived in worlds where the kind of the racial wallpapering on some level kind of supported aspects of our experience that we have had a hard time letting go of. But I think one of the things that's also become clear over the past couple of years is the extent to which even, you know, non-Indigenous communities and stuff are actually interested in engaging in these processes. And Jocelyn spoke about Orange Shirt Day, and that's a real example, because this was not, you know, led by the government. This was a kind of a practice of kind of marking that had its origins in, you know, Philip Webstad, a residential school survivor, and then was picked up by a wider public. And that has been very much an Indigenous public, but it's also been wider kind of communities of people who want to find different ways of marking Canadian history. And they have done so by wearing orange shirts at Orange Shirt Day, by bringing their children's shoes down to commemorative displays that cropped up overnight and were not funded or organized by any official body. So we've seen those sorts of movements, really, or projects come about organically, Indigenous-led, but very much sort of supported by a wider ambit of people who I think are looking for different ways to think about the place they live in and the histories that happen around them and to them and to the communities they are neighbors to.
It's interesting because we're seeing, especially since the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we're seeing just regular members of the public take up that challenge to try to respond to the calls to action. And, you know, these just community groups that have formed or changed their the scope of what they're doing to have people come and talk about history, very often Indigenous people. They want to learn about colonization in residential schools. And that's another thing that I hadn't seen until now.
Sometimes when I think about challenges, I try to remember everyone who's in the room, because sometimes when we think about challenges, we think only about, for example, residential school denialists, but we don't think about the people in the room who either don't know the history and are curious and want to learn, or people who are Indigenous or who are excluded from the curriculum in other ways so that the history that they learn is not reflective of the history that they learn in their families, for example. And so I think thinking about those people too, remembering that those are the people in the room, remembering that teachers are queer and indigenous and, you know, from different parts of the world where Canada has made it difficult for people to come from non-European countries too. And so people who are Black, who are Asian, have different histories in relation to Canada and have contributed in very important ways to Canada, but aren't necessarily told in the story. And so for so many of the us of Canada, the mainstream narrative that celebrates white men doesn't include us either. And so there are lots of people who want to see a change in how history is taught, and partly that's how history becomes relevant then to all the people who are there in the present. So I just think it's important when we're talking about pushback to also think about pushing for. And for all the people who might say, you know, we don't want to change the street names, we want to keep the street name, there are lots of people also saying we do want to change the street name. And what do we get to learn about Indigenous history, about the place that we live in, if we are listening to Indigenous ways?
So how does this project specifically address the histories of Indigenous dispossession, slavery, and systemic racism in Canada?
So I think what this project does is kind of gathers together, assesses, and engages in a conversation that has occurred in light of the recognition of those histories. So these ongoing kind of conversations about what it means to know about Canada's past, whether it's in classrooms or in research, is something that has occurred because folks, often people who are part of the communities most affected, but also people who are trained as kind of scholarly historians, sometimes the two things together have made the case that despite Canada's kind of self-serving narrative of a place without slavery, that folks, both Black and Indigenous people, were enslaved on Canadian soil. Under both French and British kind of colonial regimes.
For a long time.
For a significant period of time. And that when people, you know, became part of the Underground Railroad, they were not simply leaving a place of bondage, they were coming to a place of bondage. And that's to quote Harvey Amandy Whitfield's book title there, North to Bondage. They have made the case that Indigenous dispossession and this imagined and framed to include a whole range of issues regarding the loss of land, the loss of resources, regarding the incarceration of children in residential schools, regarding the development of a reserve system of unequal medicine in the 20th century, the net results of those parts of Canada's past has been that present-day Canada is premised on Indigenous loss and is animated by Indigenous resistance and persistence in the face of that. And we've also seen kind of similar conversations occur around kind of the recognition of the extent of anti-Asian immigration legislation and practices within Canada, within conversations regarding, you know, the impact of the internment of people of Japanese origin, most of them Canadian born in World War II, and the ongoing kind of impact of kind of racial thinking and racial logics on Canadian immigration policies. And all of this has kind of added to kind of a questioning about kind of Canada's framing of itself. And that's something that maybe Jarvis can pick up on.
Yeah, we were talking earlier while the recording was off about, you know, what is the basis for the pushback against, you know, newer histories that take all of these serious problems into account. And a lot of it is simply that people are very invested in the image they were taught of Canada, which was that we're the good guys, you know. And I was saying that it's kind of Canada's shtick, actually, that we're the benevolent ones, that we have always defined ourselves since the early 19th century, at least, if not earlier, in relation to and against the United States. The United States was the bad guy, and all the bad things they did, we didn't do. So was slavery, we talk about the Underground Railroad, if we talk about slavery at all, but we don't talk about the fact that we had slavery here for a long time for both, you know, African-American, African-Canadian people and Indigenous people. But the people who weren't taught that, who were only taught this image of the hardy pioneers and benevolent Canada, are very invested in that image of Canada, and they're offended, and they feel undermined by these newer histories that take into account, you know, dispossession and slavery and, you know, systemic racism and all the harm that it's actually done.
Which is why I think that the workshop is a really good idea, because there are lots of things that all of us don't know. And I think sometimes when you're a teacher or you're a professor or even when you're a student, you have the expectation that you should already know everything already. And so somehow it's embarrassing or it's shameful if you don't know. But all of us don't know much more than we do know. And so I think that if we can have a gathering where people understand that they're coming together knowing what they know, and people come from different places and different backgrounds and therefore know different things, but that together we can learn more and we can teach each other what we don't know. And I think the other part of it too is to think of both teaching and learning as ongoing processes. So it's not like you just teach Canadian history in 2024 and then that's just what you teach until you retire 30 years later. I think that's what professional development is all about, is understanding that learning is ongoing, and as we understand different things about the past, we can have different relationships in the present because we understand each other differently. I think that's the promise too of learning about history, that the past changes as the present changes, that it goes both ways. So I think it's a really neat opportunity as a way of beginning a conversation with people who are motivated to do that, and then to have it be something that's ongoing where there are resources that we can share, and also as people are doing this kind of work, then we have more things that we learn. And the TRC, of course, is a good example of that, just because it was such a huge amount of work that people undertook to tell stories about residential schools that weren't widely known before the TRC did its work.
What histories have you encountered as a student and as parents of students?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the things that's sort of interesting about the way, or at least I hope is interesting about the way we're approaching this project, is that we're coming to it not just as people who kind of, you know, teach history and write about history, but also about what it means to learn history in all sorts of contexts. So, and that involves, like, us thinking about our own kind of positionality in those contexts. And I grew up in British Columbia in the 1970s and 80s, and I learned almost nothing about the place that I lived in. And what I did learn about kind of local history was sometimes a kind of certain kind of project-based enthusiasm for kind of little slivers of British Columbia's past. I remember drawing Can-Can girls in grade 5, which now strikes me as a very interesting choice given the ambivalence about talking about the sex trade and colonialism. But we did represent that. We learned a little bit about the gold rush, and that was what that was associated with. But we learned, you know, next to nothing about kind of local histories other than Indigenous people framed in very kind of ethnographic terms and very much framed as kind of a past society. I remember a grade 9 or 10 textbook that I had, which was called, I kid you not, Challenge for Survival. And it was a story. It was a textbook that was used in the teaching of Canadian history for a very long time. I remember very little about it. Beyond the kind of general kind of framing, and that Canada's history was a story of white people valiantly struggling against the land and Indigenous peoples. And what I remember most was Jean Talon, the Entendant of New France, which I think I just liked the way the phrase like rolled off the tongue. I did an undergraduate degree in history and women's and gender studies. And in that 4 years, which was in the late 80s and early 1990s, I think I read one piece of scholarship, one piece of writing by an Indigenous person. and that was Rigoberta Menchú's memoir of Guatemala, which is actually a really powerful book. I still have my copy. But it strikes me as pretty revealing that the conversation had kind of begun to sort of shift. There were Indigenous history courses taught in the history department that I was studying in. But there was still a very kind of overwhelming reliance on non-Indigenous kind of perspectives, on non-Indigenous scholarship. And Indigenous kind of knowledge and Indigenous scholarship was really, you know, almost close to absent. And when it appeared, it was Indigenous peoples far away from the place that we, in fact, were living in. My own kids have had kind of a different experience. They were educated in Winnipeg, one before the curriculum changes that were made in response to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and one after. And this kind of shift that I can note in their histories, their experience of what they learned as far as Canadian histories is actually very significant. And so I think, you know, we are in a good position to assess some of the work that has been done by those changes. They had very different experiences of what they learned in kind of elementary and middle school and probably high school as well, even though they're 4.5 years apart in age. But in those 4.5 years, there was work done by people who were associated with the TRC, but also within, you know, curriculum development and stuff to provide, you know, teachers and provide students with opportunities to learn aspects of Canada's history that weren't available to this kid's sibling 5 years earlier and certainly weren't available to me.
I'm just thinking about when I became aware that my own country was a colonizing country, which was much later than it should have been, but for which I don't blame myself, but my society. But so I wanted to learn about colonization, so I went looking for the books that I assumed were written by Indigenous people about Indigenous people's history. And I was just shocked when I found out that at that time there really were almost none. And the ones that did exist were not by academic scholars. All I could get was, you know, work by non-Indigenous people.
Jarvis, I'm curious to hear about that moment for you because I remember it too. I was in third year university taking a women's and gender studies course with Elisa Trotz, and it was called something like Colonialism, Postcolonialism. And Ina Dua had come to visit our class, and she taught us about the Komagata Maru. And I was sitting in the class, and the whole course had been about colonialism, but not very much about Canada. And so as Ina was talking, I thought, oh, colonialism happened in Canada. And then I thought, I can't believe I'm in third year university and this is the first time that I understand this to be the case. And it was actually that moment that I decided to go to grad school because I realized I had so much more to learn. I felt like I had just begun learning things. And so, yeah, in some ways that moment was kind of like the beginning of the rest of everything that I did.
That's so interesting because that's basically what launched me towards grad school as well. You know, I was saying I was in Germany, and my partner at the time was German, so I was living there, and the Germans kept giving me a hard time about Indigenous people and colonization, as you said, because of all the Karl May stories, but also because, you know, of their awareness of colonization and genocide. And after I got over my first rather juvenile defensive response, they were giving me a hard time about colonization and also asking me questions about Indigenous people. And that made me realize that I did not know one thing, not one thing about Indigenous people. And that horrified me. And of course made me think, why don't I know? Why did no one teach me anything about this? And then, yeah, realizing that colonization had happened and was still happening under my nose when I was actually concerned about colonization elsewhere. I was outraged. I was mad. I felt, you know, deceived and, lied to. Hmm. And like I'd been fed a false version of my history, which I had.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I grew up in a different geographic context of Canada, and I grew up in British Columbia, where I think like a lot of parts of Western Canada, some of those recognitions are happen a little bit differently just because of the pacing of colonization and Indigenous presence. But what I do remember is I was always interested in like history as like a project of social change and of connecting to social movements, and very much came to it as somebody who was interested in gender and women's history and in labor history, and that those were the kind of ways of thinking about the past that, that provided ways of connecting the struggles of the present with history. And so very much thought I would work on that, and then I hit doing thesis research, which was the experience that it's supposed to be. It changes you. And that's, in a sense, what we always want from research. Like, we learn things, but we also shift our view. And I started coming to a kind of a topic that was generated partially about of a conversation that was happening in the kind of the early 90s, where white feminists were having to kind of account for whiteness. And this was the context where, like, Ruth Frankenberg's book, White Women, Race Matters, came out, where there was the Back of the Bus Collective in Toronto, a black women's collective kind of demanding accountability from white women. And there was this sort of a scholarship occurring both in the US and the UK and in Canada that was asking white feminists to kind of account for kind of our specificity. And in that context, I started to be interested in looking at kind of histories of whiteness and of women. And I thought I would be able to kind of tell that story. And then, but what the archives made clear is that that was a story that was necessarily bound up in Indigenous history in ways that I was not prepared for as somebody who'd been kind of gone through the training I'd gone through. But when I read newspapers from 1850s and 60s, British Columbia and Vancouver Island, which I spend a sad part of my life having done, it just became clear that there was no other way to narrate that history without kind of taking those Indigenous histories kind of in a meaningful sort of way. And then when I think about what I did know about things like, well, Indigenous history and the history of the internment of people of Japanese origin, it was what I was taught by my family, which is also really interesting. Well, not in kind of formal senses. So I remember knowing, and my parents told me that the next door neighbors had been interred during the war. And I remember my father explaining that internment camps were like concentration camps, which is, I had learned about in school. And I remember a road trip we took where my dad took my sister and I to visit a reserve in the interior of BC, which I don't remember which one it was, and to like have tea with the chief who my dad had worked with in some context. And I remember that visit and that conversation. But those were things that happened because of my family. And not that they were especially like, you know, kind of way out there and ahead of the rest of the group of kind of white British Columbians on these questions. But I think they had lived lives where these histories were part of the world in which they lived in. But that also is important, I think, to have as part of the conversation, because sometimes the response, the defensive white response, is we didn't know, but I think we often did know. We maybe didn't know in the way that we could have known. We didn't know as much. But there were a lot of these histories that were ones that we did know something about. And maybe this process of kind of reconsidering that is thinking about what we weren't taught, but also what we did learn and what we did know, and how we can also maybe honor that and push that a little more.
So what long-term changes do you hope to see in public history practices and commemorative traditions in Canada as a result of your work and this project?
Could we stop commemorating white men who have done a lot of harm knowingly, like Johnny McDonald, who mm-hmm. supported the South in the U.S. Civil War, supported slavery, for instance, and, you know, Garnet Wolseley, who came here and unleashed a reign of terror on Métis people in Red River?
Yeah, and I think the other thing we can think about doing is how maybe this research project can support work that's already being done. And I'm thinking here in particular of initiatives. And in the city of Winnipeg, there's one called Welcoming Winnipeg, which was established by the previous mayor. And is currently led by Rhianna Maraste, Elder Albert McLeod, also involves historian Dr. Erin Millions from the University of Winnipeg, Honor Black from the University of Manitoba, and other folks. And they've really come up with this very, I think, deliberative and pretty effective way of having conversations about these things. And what we've seen is the couple of ones that received a fair bit of attention, and that includes the changing of Bishop Grandin Boulevard to Abenuji Mekena, or Children's Way. Less high profile was the naming of what was called Pan Am Forest as Roostertown Park, in commemoration of the Métis community of Roostertown that was dispossessed to make way for a shopping mall and a public pool in the 1950s. So I think we can also, you know, work on sort of supporting those initiatives, but I think also just like putting these conversations in like a wider context and putting it in a context where we have a sense of kind of the long durée of how these things shift and how they can shift in the future. Hopefully in ways that mean that, you know, Indigenous kids and kids who come from racialized and migrant backgrounds, folks who are, you know, gender nonconforming, all of us who find these different ways of kind of arriving in these places, hopefully can like exist in a place where they see their own histories better reflected.
I think about the idea about people feeling bad about who they are, and I think it's really not about who you are. It's about what you do with what you know. And we all were born into a world that we didn't create, but we also are all creating the world all the time. And so I guess my hope is that we can create a world where we can all live safely, and a world where we don't destroy one another or the planet, which does seem kind of like a low bar, but maybe a better way to say it would be a world of peace and possibility. And yeah, for sure, part of that is an understanding that we all are, I guess, here for a reason, and the products of the history that brought us together, and that we can think about the idea of every child matters and creating a future where our children and their children have a safe place to live.
Thank you so much, Adele, Jocelyn, and Jarvis, for joining me today for the first episode of the History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past podcast. And thank you to everyone listening. You can follow the Center for Human Rights Research on social media through the links in the podcast description to stay informed about future History in the Hot Seat podcast episodes and stay up to date with the project. The History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past project and podcast are made possible by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council's Knowledge Synthesis Grant and the support of the Center for Human Rights Research, the University of Manitoba, the Winnipeg School Division, and UMFM.